like to officially open the meeting. This is a joint meeting, Chairperson Kumbet Karim, of Standing Committee on Finance and the Select Committee on Finance to get a briefing from National Treasury and SARS on the draft taxation laws. You are welcome and officially welcome the chairperson of the Select Committee, Honorable Eunice Karim. Do we have apologies? Secretariat?
I haven't received any apologies for the Standing Committee on Finance.
Whip.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Ngomo will join us later.
Honorable Njanda.
Chair, I was called. Good morning. I was called by Comrade Honorable Zolani Mkize. He's got a family matter.
Let's record those apologies. Ryder. Honorable Ryder.
Thank you, Chair. Just the apology of Mr. Okum. He's away the whole week in his with provincial duties.
Okay. Honorable Okum. Those are the apologies. Thanks. Let's move to the next item. Consideration and adoption of this joint meeting, Alan, to it now. Let's defer that item. Then we move to briefing by the National Treasurer and SARS on the 2019 Draft Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, 2019 Draft Taxation, the Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill, National Treasurer and SARS. Who will take the lead? Mr. Momiat. Okay, you're welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, if I may, as you can see, it's a mouthful just to pronounce all the laws that you're looking at, okay? And you're looking at four bills today. I'm going to start, if you don't mind, just the slightly, with your permission, just the other way, to start with the rates, the draft rates and monetary amounts bill, and the draft income tax amendment bill, because those are the first set of bills, and then we'll get to the complex bills. So it's one presentation that we have, but you may want to stop in between to have a discussion, so it needs to be guided by you. But what we're also doing is, because this is the first time the committee is meeting on these laws, and if I'm not mistaken, it's probably the first time the committee is meeting to consider a law in its new term, right? That I just want to explain the tax process. I know Mr. Karim will be used to it, and in fact also the rationale as to why this is a joint presentation, because part of the whole rationale is that there's a particular way you deal with most bills. They get tabled and then it comes to you. These bills don't get tabled. They come to you as draft bills so that you can make all the inputs you want and the bill can be revised, and then they get tabled because it's a money bill and it requires a particular procedure to amend them. So with your permission, I'm going to just start with a general input 10 slides so there's an understanding for the text process. If that's okay, Chair. Okay, thank you, Chair. So, Chair, the people we have here, my name is Ismail Momonia. I'm the DDG responsible for tax and financial sector policy. I should add, you'll see a lot of me, not just for the tax legislation, but the financial sector policy, because I'm not sure whether we take up 50 or 60% of your work in terms of bills that come before you. So... And, as you know, you don't deal with the expenditure bills, so you deal with these bills a lot of the time. Then you've got Yanga. Do you want to just introduce yourself?
Good morning, Chair. My name is Yanga Mputa. I'm Chief Director, Legal Tax Design and Tax Policy, and I'm dealing with the drafting of the tax bill.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Honourable Members. My name is Chris Axelson. I'm the Chief Director for the Economic Tax Analysis Unit at the Treasury.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Franz Tomasek. I'm on the SAR side, and I'm the Group Executive for Legislative Research and Development.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Honourable Members. I'm Ronel Musihane from SARS Legislative Research and Development. Thank you.
So thank you, Chair. So you can skip the contents for now. Okay. So, Chair, just to give a bit of background to the legislative mandate for taxation. Tax revenue, as you know, the Constitution has a section which says all revenue collected, unless it's exempted, I think section 214 of the Constitution, has to go into the National Revenue Fund. And once the funds come into the National Revenue Fund, they are then allocated through a budget appropriation, or in some cases there is what's called a direct charge. Now, we don't look at the appropriation bills. I think that's the Standing Committee on Appropriations which look at it. Hence, we look at one side, in a sense, of the balance sheet. Now, Section 213 of the Constitution, Section 213, which establishes the National Revenue Fund. Now, the key sections to just consider is Section 73 and 77 of the Constitution, which obligate that if it's an appropriation bill, if it's a tax bill, then basically it's called a money bill. And only the Minister of Finance can introduce tax or appropriation bills in Parliament. Nobody else, in terms of the Constitution. And then you have another clause, Section 77.3. So you've got clauses 1 and 2, which describe the procedure, or just give you the definition in 1 of what a money bill is, and 2 about the introduction of such a bill in Parliament. And Section 77.3, which I'll deal with in the next slide, requires an Act of Parliament to determine a procedure to amend money bills in Parliament. Hence, once they introduce, you have to follow that Act. It's I think the one Act where there's, in a sense, some form of constraint put in the Constitution for how Parliament considers this bill compared to other bills. Okay, so Section 77.3 says all money bills must be considered in accordance with the procedure established by Section 75. An Act of Parliament must provide for a procedure to amend money bills before Parliament. So if you bear in mind Section 75, the bill and the procedure is that it must come to the National Assembly first, and then it goes to the NCOP. And if the NCOP amends the bill from the Assembly, it goes back to the NA, and I think it can by a simple majority, I think, accept or not accept the changes made in the NCOP. That's different, just to bear in mind, with Section 76, where the provinces have, the way I see it, almost equal power with the NA. So this bill is all these bills are 75 process. Now, to make life harder for you, the Money Bills Procedure Act provides a framework, and when you have an amendment, and it's not that you can't do an amendment, and in fact, in the last Parliament, for the first time, there were amendments. Depending on whether they are technical amendments or more substantive, it has to include quite a detailed motivation. There's a process to consult with the Minister of Finance, and then you got to, when making the changes, the committee needs to look at the balance between revenue expenditure and borrowing, debt levels, debt interest costs, long-term implications for the fiscal framework, long-term impact on growth, on efficiency, equity, etc. But that's all in the Moneyball's Procedure Act. The tax policy process, so what we then do is to enable Parliament to have a say. That is why we present draft bills first. So they're not tabled or introduced formally in the House. They're simply published by the Treasury on its website. So for the publication, before they are tabled, right? Now, depending on the bills, the TLAB and the Tax Laws Amendment Bill, which is TLAB, and the Tax Administration Laws Bill are normally published in July and August. The rates bill is usually done in February with the budget, and I'll explain that in a moment. Okay, so we then come to brief you, normally in September, and normally in October, after hearings, we come with a response document to the public comments, which then informs the final bill, which is actually introduced in the House. Move on. So if you look at the annual tax process, and this is the point, the bills you're looking at today are the bills that are required to give effect to the February budget. So it's in a previous parliament that the February budget was done, and whilst the appropriation bills have been approved by the House, or I think it was one of the priorities for the new parliament, these bills have not featured yet in parliament. So we are just looking at what was the world in February when it comes to the tax bills. The tax proposals tend to be highly market sensitive, so that's why we don't ever have prior consultations. Even within government, it's a limited consultation. Like with the appropriation bill, there's a minister's committee on a budget. It goes through quite a rigorous process. The tax consultation process is, even there, it's quite limited. Obviously, the president is fully consulted and cabinet briefed towards the end of the budget process, because the tax proposals are almost done last. The tax announcements, therefore, are only made once a year on budget day, in a budget speech and in a budget review. Have you got a budget review, by the way? Okay. So I think that's quite important that in the budget review, and I don't know if members have a copy, if you don't, we'll get it for you, but there's Chapter 4, which deals with the big tax and revenue proposals for the budget. And then there's annexes B and C, which annexes C deals with the more technical proposals, whereas Chapter 4 will deal with the bigger policy proposals and all the big numbers you hear of. And annexure B provides information on the tax expenditures and so on. It just provides more detail. So that's in the budget review. And if members want a copy of this, we can arrange to get a copy from our office for members, because you may not have been here for the February budget, so I'm not assuming that. So the consultation on the structure of a tax starts immediately after budget day. So we make a budget announcement. The budget review has more details. And then the detailed consultation takes place on the TLAB and TALAB bills, okay? So, you know, either we are changing an existing tax, there might be changes to the tax base, there may be changes to the way they're administered, there may be anti-tax avoidance measures. So in other words, the structure of the tax. And we have a first round of consultation between budget day and July. We meet with those who are directly affected, because they also get a shock. Oh, this has been taxed. We start talking to them about what our intentions are. They come and they maybe provide their inputs. And that leads to the draft of the two bills. Now, to make your life more difficult, in the Constitution, the bills are split, because we often ask, why don't these two bills just be one bill? That's because the TLAB bill is a money bill. And what the Constitution says is that any other matters cannot be dealt with substantively in a money bill. So the administration issues, if it's minor, it can be dealt with in the way I understand it. But you've got to take it out and put it into a separate administration bill. Both the bills go through a Section 75 process, but the Talab is not a money bill. Okay? It's quite important to realize. So that's why the minister doesn't even formally introduce it in Parliament. On the day he introduces the TLAB bill, and often the rates bill, then what happens with the Talab is just done administratively through the parliamentary offices and the normal parliamentary process, which doesn't require a minister to come and say, I am tabling this bill or introducing it to the House. So now the consultation on rate changes is more limited. In fact, after budget day, so we change the tables on personal income tax, there could be a rate change, or we change the brackets, or we increase VAT from 14 to 15% as we did last year. Those sorts of changes tend to have a more limited, but it's not always limited, but I'm saying tend to be, because it's mainly a judgment call, made for a number of reasons. Mostly based on the amount of revenue that's required. There are other factors, but that's a big reason why we would increase rates, or in fact decrease rates as we did for many years, because we were getting substantially more money, say before the good days, 2013. After that, it's always been that we're getting less, so we've had to start increasing taxes. So the consultation on rate changes is more limited, and for that reason, we actually publish still a draft on budget day. We publish the draft rates and monetary thresholds bill. It's still our wish that Parliament will look at it immediately, but as Mr. Karim will tell you, that's not always possible, because you've got to look at the whole budget. You then have Easter break. And so it takes time, and often it's just done simultaneously with the TLAB process, as we're doing this year. We've had an election. There's no way it could be looked at earlier. So that's, but it is published earlier. As I said, that is just on what the rate is, and often it's very hard to have input about why the rate should be lower or not, because you would then actually change the entire structure of the budget. If you don't compensate with other increases. So the draft TLAB and draft TALAB are published after budget day in July. As I said, after the first round of consultations with key stakeholders. And then there's a second round that takes place after we publish in July. And we have consultations in August and September. Now, I should add, at the same time, Parliament has its, the next slide, also has its own consultation. When it publishes its notice, and often we just say to whoever is submitting comments to us to also send to Parliament. So you find it's the same set of public comments that are given. Now, given the tight timelines, because we really try to make sure that the bills are passed by Parliament, by both houses, before they rise at the end of the year. And then over December, we try and ensure the President considers the bill and signs it into law. Sometimes it's not always possible, it runs into early January. But the problem we then face is, let me give an example. You may raise VAT to 15% or so. Now, whilst we can implement it immediately, or say PIT, if Parliament should not approve the bill, the later it doesn't approve it, the more it will cause real problems. In some cases, technically, you may even have to give the money back to taxpayers, let's say in theory if Parliament doesn't pass the bill. if you've increased the rate. Okay, so it really has to be done by the end of the year, because you start running into limits in month 10, 11, 12. Okay, so because of the time limitations, that's one reason why I think that we've tried ideally, it hasn't always happened, that the NCOP and the NA, the SCOF and the CCOF, have initial joint period like done this year is the most ideal, where you've had a joint advert, you have joint hearings, and obviously once you consider that those processes will be separate and CCOF will start its process presumably afterwards. But we're very happy, and hopefully there's an agreement or an understanding between SCOF and CCOF on these processes.
And we find them and have an understanding.
Okay. But I think just as a practice that's, I think, the wisdom that's developed over time. Okay. So the first presentation like we're doing today is preferably to a joint SCOF and CCOF. And, so after the public hearings, so today we do the presentation. Next week you'll have hearings. If people feel strongly on some clauses, will definitely come and present to you. We don't respond immediately. We then normally 2 weeks later, but if you push it a week later, we then come out with a response document to say, these were the comments that we received on the text bills. This was the issue raised. We don't go by each entity. We just say, we try and bring them together on clause this. There were so many comments. These were the different comments. And having considered it, we recommend that this is how we proceed. Okay. And often because the text laws are so technical, sometimes I say, Yanga, and Renel, are you the only legal people, right? Okay. So you're the only legal person. You see, you don't even wish your worst enemy to read these laws, okay? If we want to make the committee go crazy, we say, Chair, here, there's another volume we didn't bring, but these are the laws that you have, okay, for your bedtime reading. How many laws does it have in these two books?
Six
acts, okay. Okay, and interpretation notes, okay. Now, it's important. The text bills, just go on. The text bills, therefore, are the way they're written, if you look at the actual, it will be, add this phrase, add these words, delete that. So if you read that bill, you really can't understand it. If you really want to understand it, you've got to read it against any of these 1 dozen X that we have. Okay? So the 1 dozen X could be, is it in the next slide? Yeah. So if you look at these in the third bullet, the additions and the deletions to the Income Tax Act, the VAT Act, Customs and Excise Act, the Carbon Tax Act, the ETI Act, which we haven't put down, the Tax Admin Act, many of these acts are changed in one round. And not always all of them, but that's how it works, okay? It's obviously the wording's followed word by legal practitioners, and you will meet them next week. But what we say for many of us, including some of us who aren't lawyers, we might look at the clause, but you have the explanatory memo, so the rates bill doesn't have it because it's straightforward. But the TLAB, TALAB, and this year we've got an income tax amendment bill, they have an explanatory memo. And we try and put in simple English to say, this clause has been amended and for this reason. Okay? So that's much easier to read. So I would say to members, if you want to start with the explanatory memo so that you can see clause by clause what's actually happening. Just go back to the last slide and then we'll finish off. So, okay, this is just the process I think we've been through. I won't repeat this. Just bear in mind that the tax year ends in February for personal income tax, hence why December to get the bills through is important. Next slide. Okay, you can move on. So, Chair, in terms of you'll see in our annual performance plan, the Treasury's role is largely just on tax policy and the revenue estimates. So we do that chapter 4 in a budget review. By and large, that's what we're responsible for. And the legislation typically is done by the Minister, obviously in the name of the Minister of Finance, and is done by Treasury. The admin bill SARS does most of the heavy lifting, but it's still under the auspices of the Treasury to bring legislation to the committee. Next slide. So if you look at SARS, it's responsible for the collection of revenue. We work very closely together on policy and revenue matters, but it's important to know that SARS has full autonomy in terms of administration. And so the NT is not allowed to have sight of any taxpayers' affairs. We don't know how, when we have a law, what the impact will be on any taxpayer. Obviously, SARS will understand it. We can't also tell SARS, this is how you implement the law. They have to interpret the law once they start doing it and so on. So on administrative issues, they are clearly the lead, and in fact, the only real structure that has the information. Move on. So then getting to the bills themselves for this year. So that was just, Chair, just an oversight of why this process works that way, why it's different from other legislation that you'd be considering. If it came out with financial sector legislation, it would be tabled, and then you'd be having more formal hearings. But these are the hearings that you have when the bills are in draft form. I don't know, Chair, if there's any questions on that before we get to the bills themselves.
The Chair, to just go out. On matters of process, I think both sides have had briefings on the money bills, actually. And Mr. Ryder, we're getting a further one, just so we can squeeze it in. Okay, is there any question? No. Okay, good. Shall we move on? Yes, Dikilin.
Thank you, Captain. And good morning. Chris, long time not seeing you. I don't really have much, but I just want to have a clarity in terms of the procedure. And now being in the NCOP, one understands the rules. The procedure that you just outlined about the public participation. I think it's on slide 7. That consultation process is done after the Minister of Finance has delivered the bill. Only then can be published, or you can get into a process of consultation. What I want to verify is that is this because of the sensitivity of the matter, or is it legislated that consultation should be done after the budget has been presented? The other matter is on the after the NA have presented or taken a decision on the budget, I mean on the bill, it's sent to NCOP. NCOP legally they can decide not to agree with what comes from NA or make amendment. And then in such case, the bill will be sent back to NA. So what I want to understand is from that point, what is going to happen? What is the act saying legally? Is now going to start afresh the NA debate and deal with the amendment that comes from NCOP and then take it back to NCOP, or what is happening? Because my understanding, which is very little, is that before it goes to the president, it must be finalized in the NCOP. If you can clarify that process for me, thank you.
Yes, thanks, Chair. I think my question also is around the timing of the consultation on the structure of the text. And My question is whether we would have done that regardless of the administration that is at the helm. I'm taking it that the essence of the process here is that we have confidence in the pronouncement of the minister. And my view, therefore, is what then would have been the case if we had a different administration with different policies? Would we then not have a nightmare in terms of a consultation timing? Thanks, Chair.
Anybody else? No? Okay, over to you, the team.
Okay, so, no, I think those are really very good questions and something that there's no final answer to, and ultimately I think lawyers will have to weigh in. The way I understand it is, and the parliamentary lawyers who know the rules of parliament and so on. So let me deal with your second question first, which is that obviously the NCOP has every right to run the process the way it wants to, okay? And if it were to make amendments, then the way I would understand it, it would go back to the NA. Now, this is subject to, I don't know if the parliamentary lawyers are here, but they would, I don't think they have to have another public process, but they consider the changes made by the NCOP and then decide on it. And again, it's up to the NA what type of process they want to run. And it could be a quick process, it could be a longer process. But once they decide, I think they accept or reject the changes made or amend it, and that's final. It doesn't go back to the NCOP because it's a Section 75, these are Section 75 bills. So that's the way it would work. I think for us, when I talk about having a joint agreement, in a sense, it helps to say if the SCOF says we will take so many weeks and finish by this time, because if we are to pass the bills by the first week in December, it does mean that one needs to be clear how long the NCOP is also going to take on the bill, and the two houses and the committees have to come to that understanding. So it's up to you. I'm just outlining how things have worked in the past. When it comes to the consultations that we do, the committee still looks at the formal consultations. So after the public hearings, you hear directly from people what their views are on the amendments. Okay, and you are hearing from us about how we recommend that you as a committee respond to it. Now, part of it is these text proposals are very complex, and it's not reasonable to expect anyone, even on our side, to understand all the issues. It's only when you hear people come and say, this clause, you're amending it this way, but do you realize this is what it will mean? Okay. It's only once you put it out that you know the impact on particular taxpayers. So if they come, and certainly if it's a company, they will come. If it's an individual, they won't even know. Okay, so there's a bit of asymmetry of response. But the tax advisors are all here. They wait for this every July. They will come and you'll get all the arguments. And then you have to have, in the one slide I say, the wisdom of Solomon, okay, when it's a very contested issue about what to do. So we come and we put it before you, and you can accept what we say or not accept what we say. Because we've done it in a draft form, once you agree on a response document, if you agree, you amend it, we then go back and we amend the law. And that's what I want to get to. So your first question on the consultation. So we make the text announcement. If you look at this document, you'll see that it says very little. And when you're a company, you want to know exactly how it impacts on you. Now, the rate changes might be clear, But when there's base changes, we are often describing the problem. So you don't really know exactly how it's going to change. So the consultation that we do, not on the rates book, because the rates are clear, but on the tax-based changes, the administration changes, from budget day in February, say it might be 23rd, right up to a month before July, we have these meetings. And that is really to say exactly how we're going to change, should we change that clause. And we actually do the bill so that you're writing it out to say clause 712, add this, subtract this, this is how you want to amend it. And that's why when we publish the bill, then the second round is actually, even for companies, is the first time they see how we're actually going to do it. And in terms of the law, their lawyers, their tax advisors read the actual words, and they, even if they agree in spirit to the change, but the words may not reflect that. So they will then come and engage on the wording of the bill. And that's what you face as well, that the hearings of the changes to the words. So it's two different, the first one is still conceptual that we do before July, but after July it's the actual words in the clause, and that's all that matters at the end of the day when we all finish with the bill. It's what is then written in this book, and SARS will interpret it, these books of all the laws, okay, that people like Yanga read and they carry around. Hey? No, I'm not. I don't do it myself. We leave it to the Yangas of this world to do it. But we leave a copy for the chair.
Okay, just one quick thing. What we've done in the past, Comrade Chair, because the tax bills, it's your call as the NN by a committee, but what we did in the last 5 years, as declared in the court, is sometimes it's impossible, given the deadline, to completely finish in a committee. So we set up a subcommittee, we called it the tax subcommittee, which had two ANC, one DA, and one EFF, and they would meet. But the terms, once the bill is with us, even if it's informal, then it's under our watch, as it were. They can't just do what they want. But we used to pack them off to Pretoria, Swanee, and sometimes our people would fly there because it's easier for the stakeholders to come. The first thing to say is that that's one process, Comrade Chair and colleagues, you can think about. But two is that actually, to be fair to Treasury, we may disagree with them and so on and many things, but when it comes to consultation, they do consult quite vigorously. Thirdly, obviously nowhere in the world, when it comes to the rates and monetary amounts, is there consultation. You can't do that. You can't say you're going to increase cigarettes by so much or liquor by so much, and people will just run and hoard, or you're going to increase income tax. I don't think anywhere in the world they announced that before. So that one is correct. But the other two bills, there's still room for, you know, us to discuss and see what we can do. But it's something that the two committees, and especially the NA committee, needs to apply its mind to. Thank you. Can we move on to the bills? Because I'm there's quite a lot to go through. But sorry, Dick Litt.
Chair, my apologies to come after you've spoken.
No,
this one is not for
for
Treasury, but I think it's something that I want to share. They can close their eyes if it's not meant for them. I mean their ears. Chair, the process of the bill, sometimes it becomes unfair in terms of time frame for NCOP after it has been processed in NA. Hence, I'm saying this is for us as members to make sure that we work as a team. Once NA starts, introducing the process of the bill amendment or whatever, we need to invite the NCOP so that we are part of the whole process. Because after you are done with it, it's only a few days that is left for NA, for NCOP to deal with it. And NCOP, in most cases, they fight amongst themselves to say, we are rubber stamping. We don't have enough time to deal with it. So it will only help both houses that once we start with the process of processing bills, we do it jointly. Thank you.
No, it's a discussion we're going to be having with the NHA. But just to say also that I know Dennis has been strongly about it, slightly so. We had a meeting, a multi-party meeting, which unfortunately on that side, what we agreed on is that we confer all the time, but there's a certain time where we step back because we are an independent house and we cannot be subordinate to the NA, and then there'll be constitutional and legal challenges. So we have discussed it, he's agreed so far, and I think maybe at the next meeting of SICOF we can bring it to the meeting. So yes, I mean, to have a briefing together, I think this should be standard, because there's nothing to lose, because the bill we get on that side will be the amended bill. It's not the original bill. So we need to know what was there originally. Secondly, the value of having joint public hearings is that we hear people, so many people coming who don't come on that side to the NCOP. So we understand, and there are times when there may be somebody makes a public submission, an NGO, for example. The NA turns it down, but we may decide, no, we agree with that NGO. Now, if we were here in the first instance, we'll understand why the NGO has a particular position. So it's both working together, but retaining our relative independence. We agree. Thank you.
On the bill now, please.
On the bill, please.
So thank you, Chair. And it would be music to our ears if there is a formal agreement, because I think this is a practice that needs to continue and evolve with time, so that no house feels that it's been pushed in terms of time and so on. So it
yeah.
would be great, I think, to just...
Not particularly why she didn't ask that over the last 5 years, but she wasn't...
Okay, so to get to the bills this year, right, let's go through the next slide. So if you look at the budget this year, Tris, do you want to just go through this quickly?
Thanks, Mama. Thanks, Honourable Members. So, just as has been discussed, the budget comes out of changes to rates, and a lot of these rate changes and the revenue-raising changes are in what's called the Draft Rates and Mandatory Amounts and Amendments of Revenue Laws Bill. So at the time of the budget, you know, we estimated there would be about a $42.8 billion shortfall for the 2018-19 year, which is last year, compared to the estimate at the beginning of the year. So part of the discussions around the fiscal framework that was agreed to by the Ministry of Finance was that we needed to raise $15 billion in additional tax revenue. So these measures to raise revenue were in Chapter 4 of the budget, and then Annexure C included other tax proposals, and Annexure B dealt with the tax expenditure. So I'll go through the amendments that are in the draft rates bill. So in order to raise $15 billion, the main proposals were not to provide any inflationary relief for the personal income tax brackets, but to give a 1.1% increase in the primary, secondary, and tertiary rebates, which affects your tax-free threshold. No inflationary adjustments to the medical tax credits, an increase in the eligible income band for the employment tax incentive that wasn't a revenue raiser, above inflation increases for excise duties on alcohol and tobacco, increase in the health promotion levy, a below-inflation increase in the general fuel levy, but then with the new carbon tax levy on fuel that coincided with the introduction of the carbon tax on 1 June 2019. So this is a table from Chapter 4 in the Budget Review, which just shows the top-line item you can see there, shows the $15 billion that we were trying to raise, and these items show where that $15 billion was raised from. So you can see the main one is from not adjusting the personal income tax brackets for inflation. And here are the other ones I mentioned.
So Chair, those are just the changes, okay? And then you see the total, that's $1.4 trillion. So it's a lot of money we're talking about that we raised.
Yeah, 1.407 before tax and then 1.422 after tax to sort of help with revenue shortfalls as well as some expenditure priorities. This is just a chart, so we got most of the additional revenue this year from personal income tax. This is just showing that that's basically what we've been doing over the last quite a few years. So personal income tax as a proportion of total revenue has been increasing quite a lot. Here is the increase from the new rate of the value-added tax, so there's quite a big increase there. So if you look at the draft rates mandatory amounts and amendments to revenue laws bill, this includes the income tax, excise duties, and the employment tax incentive. A lot of these measures are either implemented immediately, so the excise duties on alcohol and tobacco are effective immediately, as the minister announces. Some of them are effective from 1 March, usually on the personal income tax side, because your personal income tax year goes from March to the end of February, and some of them are from 1 April, which coincides with the fiscal year. So, and for example, the fuel levies are on the first Wednesday of April, that increase. There are some changes in that are announced in the chapter that aren't included in this bill. That's the general fuel levy, the RAF levy, the carbon tax levy on fuel, and the health promotion levy, which are done through schedules that are published by SARS and approved from the minister. And we've spoken about the process. This is just to quickly show you what will be in the bill. These are the personal income tax tables on how you pay your personal income tax and how you'll pay as you earn is withheld. You'll see that this is the table on the left-hand side is the one from 2018-19, and the one on the right is the one from 2019-20, and there was no change this year, so we didn't make any changes there. In previous years, we've increased for inflation. In the bottom part of the table, we have increased slightly the primary rebate, which affects your tax-free threshold. So in the previous personal income tax year, if you earned below 78,150, you didn't pay tax. This has been increased slightly to 79,000. And then also a slight increase in the tax-free threshold for those above the age of 65 and those above the age of 75. And so those are the adjustments that will be in this draft bill. We also didn't change, just as one point, so what is the, we also published in the budget what we think the distributional impact will be according to these tables. In the green box on slide 23, you can see that in effect, we provided relief of $1.2 billion by increasing the rebates, and you can see which income brackets that relief went to. So by increasing the primary rebate, a lot of the relief goes to those on lower income. We also didn't change the medical tax credit. So we announced 2 years ago that the medical tax credit would be adjusted by an amount lower than inflation to fund the NHI and the rollout of the NHI. That has continued this year, and there will be another less than inflationary adjustment that's in the baseline for next year. And we've also shown the distributional impact there. You can see that the additional $1 billion that we get from not adjusting for inflation, a lot of that comes from the middle incomes. We also changed then the excise burdens on alcohol and tobacco. We have a policy where we try and target the excise burden for wine, beer, and spirits to 11%, 23%, and 36% of the weighted average retail selling price. So this isn't in legislation, but it's a policy target that we've publicly stated. So we try and get to the tax to around those levels. We also try and have a targeted excise burden for tobacco of 40% of the retail selling price of the most popular brand. Also, again, it's not legislated. It's sort of a policy direction. This year, we increased those duties by amounts above inflation in order to raise additional revenue. And as a result, those targeted excise burdens, the actual targeted excise burden, will be slightly above the ones that we've stated of 11, 23, 36, and 40 for tobacco. The employment tax incentive change is also in this bill. We introduced it in 2014. The eligible income brackets at which you can claim the employment tax incentive hadn't been changed since 2014. So we've done, in effect, an inflationary change this year. So we've increased the income at which you can claim the maximum amount for the employment tax incentive for eligible employees from 4,000 Rand a month to 4,500 Rand a month. So if your employee earns from now up to 4,500 Rand per month, they can get the full 1,000 Rand per month employment tax incentive. And that gets tapered down to zero at 6,500, which previously was 6,000. So we've just shifted those income brackets up slightly. And then I've mentioned some of the measures that aren't in the rates bill. An inflationary increase in the health promotion levy to 2.21 cents per gram of sugar, above the threshold of 4 grams of sugar per 100. The 15 cent per litre increase in the general fuel levy, 5 cent per litre increase in the road accident fund levy, and the new carbon tax levy on fuel, which comes out to less than 10 cents per litre increase. Okay, on the carbon tax, Chair, I don't know if you want to stop for questions there or move.
We're going through it ever so fast, but the new members, please note that when we go through the bill line by line, you will get a better sense. And when you have submissions from the public, you will get a much, we will get a much better sense of what the pros and cons are of each of these. But for now, are there any questions? Yes, Dion?
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 23, there is reference to no increases in the medical tax credits to assist the funding in the NHI. Obviously, this is a process ongoing, but we have seen that the legislation for NHI is now upon us. And what I want to know from Treasury is that, I mean, have they factored in the potential, in my view, tsunami wave of cost for the NHI coming? Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions?
No, the question is no. I mean, I think that, remember that any amendments, even to the NHI bill that deals with taxes, has to come to this committee. And to the extent that, because it's a money bill issue, firstly, okay. Obviously, the bigger issue, as you know, on the NHI, the Treasury is working on a finance paper on the potential impact cost-wise and the method for funding and so on. But yeah, we're still sort of working on that, which we hope will be published in a few weeks. I mean, I should add that obviously once you have major proposals like those, it's important to take the both the funding and the actual you know, legislation. One needs to just have a comprehensive approach towards NHI and incorporate the financial issues as well.
Okay, the next set are, this isn't in the rates bill, this is in the income tax amendment bill, and it's in relation to some carbon tax amendments. So there were two proposals in Chapter 4. The one was on the 12L energy efficiency savings tax incentive. The sunset date for that was is in 2020. In order to provide, you know, further relief for mining, iron and steel and other energy-intensive users, as well as to commit to the recycling of revenues from the carbon tax, that 12L energy efficiency savings tax incentive was extended through the first phase of the carbon tax up until 1 January 2023. That's this part from the draft tax amendment on slide 29. Oh, no, that's actually on slide 30. So that is an extension of the energy efficiency savings tax incentive, which was part of Chapter 4. If you go to slide 29, sorry, I had it the wrong way around. This was the repeal of 12K of the Act, which was a tax exemption for certified emission reductions. So previously, if you did a project that would reduce your emissions and you got credits through the Clean Development Mechanism, which is a specific mechanism from the Kyoto Protocol, which has a lot of standards that you need to apply to, and you can get certified by that Clean Development Mechanism, then the revenue you gain from selling those credits was exempt from tax. So that was already in the Act under 12K. From the introduction of the Carbon Tax Act, for those same projects, you can now use carbon offsets. So you can use the project, reduce your emissions, but then you can use it to reduce your carbon tax liability or to sell it to someone else so that they can reduce their carbon tax liability. Now, we didn't want companies to be able to have both benefits, both an exemption under the Clean Development Mechanism and the carbon tax offset. So now we're repealing 12K of the Income Tax Act so that they only use the carbon tax offset of that reduction. So those are the two measures in the draft Income Tax Amendment Bill. And then there are, now in a different bill than the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, but there are carbon tax amendments, so I'll quickly go through those. Okay. So these are there are some technical amendments also related to the carbon tax that are in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. The one is just on the threshold applied for being liable for the carbon tax. We said it must, if you meet that threshold or are above the threshold, then you'll be liable for the tax. Previously it was only if you were above the threshold, so it's quite technical. The other one was in Section 4 for the tax base. So there are three different methodologies that companies can use in order to clarify what their emissions are and report them to the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries. And we call those Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3. So there have been clarifications that have been put into the bill to make that more explicit. So there are these IPCC guidelines on how you determine what your emissions are as a company. So you can either use those guidelines or the country-specific guidelines, and if you use those guidelines in terms of how you determine your emissions, you'll be in Tier 1 or 2. Or if you have a DEF-approved company-specific guideline, because it's not done by the IPCC, you can use Tier 3. So we've tried to clarify that. Then we've also just made some technical changes on the formulas, from conversions from kilograms to tons, from volume to mass. And we've also changed this, how the carbon tax will increase over time in terms of CPI. The previous bill, you couldn't actually make the calculation because the data wasn't available yet, so we've just changed it so that you can use the latest available data. And then also clarify the basic tax-free allowance, that it's not just for fuel consumption, but that it's for all companies that get a basic tax-free allowance.
Yeah, I should just make the point. I mean, you see, we've just passed the bill, but tax is unfortunately a very dynamic process. So as you see difficulties, they have to get fixed up. And hence you see amendments, or it gets updated. And Chris has used many acronyms here, IPCC, Tier 1, Tier 2. You know, at some point we could go into that detail, but it, for the moment I think just see them broadly as sort of technical amendments, I guess. Not in all cases, but we can deal with it when we deal with it above. But just be aware that you're using terms that you should maybe explain to members.
Thank you, Chair. We have it in the explanatory memorandum. Chair and the committee members, this year we've got this 2019 draft income tax amendment bill, which has got two provisions relating to environmental tax incentives. This bill was published, first we published the draft TLAB normally on the 21st of July, and we published this later on the 30th of July, because it has got these two proposals relating to carbon tax incentives. With the permission of the state law advisor and parliament, we're going to request, when we take the bills to the state law advisor, that they include this bill, these provisions in the draft TLAB, and then we end up with the normal three bills. But it will depend with the permission of the parliament as well as the state law advisor, so that we don't have four bills, we have three bills. Thank you. Yes.
There are extraordinary times where we do have another round, and we call it the revenue laws tax. So, you know, it can be forever, okay?
There is one item, there's other tax-related bills expected in the next few months, and then there's amendment to the SARS Act, I think, Momo.
Yeah, in the budget documents, we did talk about the Nugent Commission proposals had just come out, and Cabinet has largely adopted the Nugent Commission proposals. There is further work to be done, like, say, the role of the Inspector General. On those, we intend to come out with a paper. I mean, they deal with, like, governance improvements, a process, more clarity on a process for the appointment, and importantly, removal of the commissioner, which isn't there in the current act. And also, there's no provision for deputy commissioners, so they had asked us to formalize these changes. So We hope to bring this through very early next year to have Israeli, and hopefully before the end of the year to have some of the papers published. Then, two, we have committed that we would strengthen the office of the tax ombud. Again, we're leaving this for early next year, just given the election year two. It's difficult then to have a whole new bill, because at the moment those provisions are part of the income tax, the Tax Admin Act. Okay, so we do need to formalize that, but we also need to take into account what Nugent has said. So it's something, and I know the judge is in a hurry to get these powers, but we are working on it, and we will have it early next year. And the tax.
The last one on the item.
So these are not dealt with in these bills.
These are not dealt with in this bill, but this one, the SA Kuwait tax treaty. I think it is important to bring you it to you, because what happened is that before there's a protocol for amending the tax treaty signed, we have to do informal proceedings in Parliament. But these ones, we did it in 2008 and 2009, because in 2007 we announced the changes from secondary tax on companies to dividend withholding tax, and we had to negotiate 10 tax treaties with those countries. So we did the renegotiations, and we did bring the matter to Parliament. But there's only one outstanding protocol amending tax treaty that has not been signed since 2007, is the Kuwait tax treaty. So now, this, for the last 10 years, we've been asking Kuwait to sign the protocol. We've done the informal briefings then, but we think that we must bring the matter to you. But now, this has become a matter of national importance, because we lost the court case in South Africa on the 12th of June, and in Netherlands, they lost the court case on the 18th of January. So, meaning that SARS has to pay refund. So when we told Kuwait that this is a matter of national importance, because if they do not sign this tax treaty, we're going to terminate the tax treaty, and we have to bring it to you, for because termination of the tax treaty has to go to Parliament. So now they are now willing to sign the tax treaty, because they are afraid of the termination of the tax treaty. So now what is happening is that they've agreed to come on board, and they've shown commitment to sign. So we wish to sign this protocol by before the end of September, if we do not want to pay more refunds on the dividends. So they've promised to sign, but it depends on them. But if we do not sign latest this year, we will be left with no choice but to terminate the tax treaty, because we have to pay refunds in the billions of rands, based on the fact that we've lost the court cases. And for the past 10 years, we've been begging Kuwait to sign the tax treaty. So we're bringing it to your attention, because now we are preparing the presidential minute to sign the tax treaty. Thank you.
So, Chair, I would suggest we...
If you want to just take a round of questions, then we'll come to the T-Lab, because this will has dealt with the rates bill and the income tax amendment bill. The hard work will start with the T-Lab and Talab, Chair. This is the easier bit.
Are there questions up to so far? Honorable Ryder, George, Mavile.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question relating to the carbon tax, the sugar tax, and then also the freezing of the medical tax credits. Are these proceeds going to be ring-fenced? Because obviously there's... reasons why we're starting to tax these things. Is there an intention to ring fence, or is it at least quantifiable? Is it something that can be measured over time, that we can have a look and see how much has been collected in terms of the carbon tax and how much has been spent directly on environmental issues as a result of that? The same obviously with sugar tax and the medical tax credits, bringing into medical spending. Are we going to be able to quantify it over time? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. It is pleasing that the South Africa-Kuwait matter has been resolved. I just wanted to ask about the other tax agreements. Obviously, there are several others. I just wanted to know whether there weren't any others that were affected in the same way, or whether it was only these 10. Thank you.
It's only a comment, Chair. Thank you. On the Kuwait, we trust the wisdom, what did you say, of Sodoma, and we'll be guided by you. Thank you.
Okay. Responses?
One more.
Thanks, Honourable Members. On the ring fencing of the revenues and the quantification, so we do try and quantify all the revenues we get. That's in the statistical annexure of the budget, so it's tables 2 and 3. We've got very detailed line items of all the different taxes that we collect, that SARS collect, and we present. We do also, in annexure B of the budget review, try to quantify expenditures from tax incentives. So, for example, the 12L energy efficiency saving tax incentive that we have extended, in effect, that was seen as a revenue recycling measure for the carbon tax, even though it was brought in before the carbon tax. If you look at annexure B of the budget review, we've in effect given up tax revenue of close to $3 billion over the last 3 years of that incentive. In our view, that is part of the revenue recycling measures of the carbon tax, and that's why we're extending this incentive. The sugar tax, we haven't...
No sugar tax.
The sugary beverage tax, excuse me, the health promotion levy, we have not explicitly earmarked or ring-fenced any of those funds. The freezing of the medical tax credits, this is an interesting one because we announced it last year and we had a below inflationary increase, which then in effect provided $4.3 billion over the next 3 years to fund the NHI program over that three-year period. In this budget, we've actually gone further and not increased it at all, which made additional funds available for the National Revenue Fund and for general expenditure. So by not increasing the medical tax credit, only a portion of it went to NHI and the other portion of it went for revenue-raising measures. I think the general theme you'll see here is that we don't, we would not recommend fixed earmarking, but we are open to what we call soft earmarking, where we say that we will raise something and then we will provide funds available. Similar scenario for the tire levy and other programs.
But can I just come in? Yes, we don't like excise taxes. It's inefficient. And generally, our budget process and information is very transparent. So yes, you will get per tax the amounts collected and so on. And that is, anyway, not a good determinant on whether it's enough or too much money on a particular item. But I think the broader point that, yes, we have essentially put in place the carbon tax to reduce emissions and you want to get a change in behavior. So that's the rationale for those taxes.
On the issue regarding the Kuwait matter, yes, it was only those 10 tax treaties. They are all documented also in the court papers. And all of them signed and we ratified. It's only Kuwait that has been outstanding for the past 10 years.
Okay. We can proceed with the presentation. How far are you? Was the select committee have to leave for another meeting?
Okay. On the draft TLEP now, we are coming to the technical text proposals. The first proposal, we are bringing to you some of the proposals that we think they are more important and whereby we have received a lot of comments. The first proposal is reviewing the tax treatment of surviving spouses' pension. I think you remember at the end of the last year whereby the surviving spouse marched to the Minister of Finance's offices because what is happening was that during the lifetime of a spouse, if the spouse contributes to the retirement fund, the income is tax deductible. So upon death of a member, the surviving spouse is entitled to receive an annuity. So what happens is that when the surviving spouse is receiving that annuity, it's added as the second income in his hands if the surviving spouse is also receiving another salary, and pushes the surviving spouse to another tax bracket. So they came to us to say that there's financial burden, because at the end of the tax year, SARS will assess the tax liability, and then they are pushed to the next bracket. So, but you said this is how the tax system works, because if the tax system looks at, do you have two salaries, do you have one salary? So it will be difficult to make separate measures for you to break the tax system. But you said in order to alleviate the burden, maybe we can make changes in the tax legislation to say that the pension funds that are paying annuities to the surviving spouse, they should not take into account the rebate, so that it lessens the tax burden at the end of the year of the surviving spouse. So we had meetings with the surviving spouse, they even wrote to the parliament early this year, and we had meetings with them. So we told them this is how we're going to solve the problem. But it also needs also taxpayer education and also communication with the retirement funds and GPF.
Thank you. The next issue is on bulk payments to former members of closed funds. So previously, funds that had been closed, there were amounts that were still in the funds that were due to members. Now, there is no mechanism in the Income Tax Act for those funds after the retirement fund has been closed to be paid to beneficiaries in a tax-free manner. This was that we tried to solve this issue in 2009 by publishing a special notice to allow this in very particular circumstances. The proposal here is that these funds are still available, and there are some deregistered funds, and the funds are held by administrators, that we would change the second schedule of the Income Tax Act to allow for this process to happen again, so that these amounts that are owed to beneficiaries can then be paid to them tax-free, but only according to this special regulation that's put through the Minister of Finance. We're working with the Financial Sector Conduct Authority on this. The next changes on an exemption relating to annuities from a provident or provident preservation fund. At the moment, there's a Section 10 Cap C in the Act, which allows for if you receive an annuity, but you didn't receive a deduction on the amounts that were used to contribute to fund that annuity, that then you could receive that annuity tax-free. Because if you didn't receive it tax-free, in effect, we would be taxing you twice, because we'd be taxing you because you didn't receive a deduction when you contributed to retirement fund, but then we'd be taxing you again when you received that money. So this is allowed for pension funds and pension preservation funds and retirement annuity funds, but it wasn't allowed for provident or provident funds because there was no requirement to annuitize. But we would still, as an objective of government, we would still like provident and provident fund members to annuitize. So if they now annuitize, purchase an annuity at retirement, and they didn't receive a deduction, they'll be able to receive some of those amounts tax-free.
The next one is extending the scope of amounts constituting variable remuneration. This is a very important amendment because it hits those employees who receive night shift allowance and standby allowance or your overtime pay. So what happens is that it may happen that in this year you are supposed to be receiving a bonus or an overtime pay, but it is paid in the following year. So this provision matches the time of receipt with the time of accrual, the time when the money is paid to you, and with the year in which maybe they're going to say that we're going to sign that you're going to receive your money, but it's paid maybe in the following month or in the following year. So what happens is that the current provisions in the Income Tax Act, we're told that they are so limiting because we name those amounts. And then there was those like night shift allowance, standby allowance, whereby they are not named. So we're trying to address this anomaly by extending the scope to be wide. But that's when Momo is saying that we will try to address something, but they say now it's administratively burdensome. So you're going to see on the comments that you're going to receive whereby we're trying here to say that instead of saying night shift allowance, standby allowance, or overtime pay, we're going to have characteristics of those amounts, the amounts whereby they're not accrued to you. You don't know when you're going to receive them. But they say now the scope is too wide, so the detail is in the wording.
Okay.
The next one is the business tax, of which we see that we've got our tax practitioners here. The first one is addressing abusive arrangements aimed at avoiding the anti-dividend stripping provisions. Currently, the Income Tax Act, that's where most of the bulk of amendments are made, on the anti-avoidance measures. Because when you have specific anti-avoidance measures, each and every time you make an amendment, then they'll try and make another scheme so as to avoid the current provisions in the Income Tax Act. The Income Tax Act contains anti-avoidance rules dealing with dividend stripping, and they are aimed at preventing tax-free extraction of profits through exempt dividends. So in 2017, we made changes in the Income Tax Act so as to prevent this. But our changes were too specific to say that if you pay dividends within 18 months of disposal, then those dividends will be regarded as extraordinary dividends and they will attract tax. So what we have found is that before budget this year, there were schemes whereby now they do not actually dispose the shares. They dilute the shareholding in the company and the effective interest in the company becomes lower because of the dilution. So this year, we have to make provisions so as to try and pinpoint those schemes. So this is meant at the issues whereby there is no actual disposal, but when you do dilution of the shares of the company, and that dilution leads to the value of the shares in the company being minimal. The next one is correcting anomalies arising from applying anti-value shifting rules. The Income Tax Act contains anti-value shifting rules aimed at, they want to make sure that if you make an asset for share transaction, the value of the asset must be equal to the value of the share. These are also anti-avoidance measures. So it has come to our attention that normally the right of period in the asset, which is when you do it in terms of accounting terms, is different from the right of period when you do it according to the income tax principles. And now when you've got different right of period, different values because of the right of period based on the accounting standards versus the income tax standards, that triggers the anti-value shifting rule. So what we are trying to assert here to say that if there is an accounting standard which is different from the income tax standards, the depreciation, the difference in the right of period should not trigger these rules. So here we are trying to assist. The next one is refining provisions around special interest deduction for debt-funded share acquisitions. Currently, the Income Tax Act makes provision for if you go and get a loan in order to buy shares in a company, then you get deduction. This is a very special rule. So what happens is that in order for you to get a deduction, you must meet certain criteria. That is, you must have actual control in that company. You must have a controlling shareholding in that company. So what happens is that the controlling may be indirect or direct. So it may be indirect, but because you control the holding a company that acquired shares in that actual operating company. So it has come to our attention that if someone had an indirect controlling shareholding in that company, and then now there is a company restructuring whereby there is unbundling. They are not sure that when you have indirect controlling and then you move to direct controlling shareholding, can you still be able to deduct interest based on that loan? So we are making it easy to say that if you are moving from indirect to direct, then you can still have special interest deduction. The next rules is clarifying the interaction between corporate reorganization rules and other provisions of the Income Tax Act. Currently, South Africa does not have group taxation. But what we have special rules from Section 42, from Section 41 to Section 47 of the Income Tax Act, whereby we call it corporate restructuring rules. These rules make provision to say that if you are doing mergers and acquisitions, unbundling transaction, you can transfer your assets tax-free, and then they are deferred, provided that it's happening within the same group of companies. Because we don't have group provisions, so we have these special rules only for the corporate reorganizations. Now, the problem is that the Income Tax Act has special rules in Section 24J dealing with interest-bearing instruments, and Section 24I dealing with tax treatment of exchange items. So it has been brought to our attention that now when you are doing the corporate reorganization rules in terms of Section 41 to 47 and then you transfer your assets tax free. Now, do you apply when you have interest bearing instrument and exchange items, do you apply the corporate organization rules, or you apply those special rules in Section 24I and Section 24J? So we are clarifying here to say that the exchange bearing instruments and the exchange items will be treated in terms of the specific rules, even if you are entering into the reorganization transactions. So you won't qualify for the reorganization transaction provisions or deferral of tax when you are transferring these assets. These assets will be dealt with in terms of Section 24J and Section 24I. The next one is clarifying the interaction of corporate reorganization rules regarding the degrouping charge and the controlled foreign companies. As you have said, that we've got these corporate reorganization rules that allow for the tax neutral transfer of assets. So what happens is that this only happens if you are within a group of companies. So if a taxpayer got the benefit of these rules, but within 6 years leaves the group, then you trigger tax on those assets. And this is an anti-avoidance measure. And this is intended to say that you cannot within 6 years leave the group, because we gave you the group taxation or the deferral of taxes because you are within the group. So you must stay at least within the group for 6 years. So what happens is that also this happens within also the controlled foreign company rules. So if you leave, if you are no longer a CFC, then you also trigger these rules. So the issue was, it's a small issue, but it's the timing which is very important for CFCs, to say that the timing for the CFC is different for the timing with regard as contemplated in the company organization rules. So here we are aligning the timing. The last one which came to our attention, it was that our corporate reorganization rules do not cater for deregistration by operation of law. For instance, in terms of Section 116 of the Companies Act, you may be required to deregister. So here we are trying to align the provisions of the Income Tax Act with the provisions of the Companies Act, so that if you are required in terms of Section 116 to deregister, then you will be able to qualify for the corporate reorganization rules. Must I continue?
Can we take questions? Honorable George, Honorable Ntateso. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question on slide number 40, where it makes reference to surviving spouses' pensions, and that there would be this process to alleviate the financial burden, because obviously when you add them up together, the person might well be in a higher tax bracket. It makes reference to pension funds, payments by pension funds. Will the same apply to living annuities and annuities? Because many, probably most surviving spouses get paid by those particular products. Thank you.
Yes, Chair. Strangely, I had an interest on the surviving spouse fund as well. Mine is based on fear that the legislation does it compare, or is it greater than the will? Which one comes first? Because you have somebody hoping to get some income when you pass on, whichever way you pass on, and you have a will somewhere. Which one supersedes which between the two? If I'm clear with the question. Okay, and then the 24J, Chair, forgive me, because young I so smooth in these terms, I get lost along the way. I wish I had the wisdom of Solomon. The 24Js and I's of the Act, if that can be unpacked a bit, I would really be. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. Where do we place churches and other religious bodies which are making a lot of money into this world? in terms of taxation. Religious bodies, churches and so on, which are out there making lots of money, and I think they are registered as NPOs, and but the money that they make is more than what is made by business or companies which are paying taxes. Then
thank you. With regarding to the surviving spouse, we just said pension funds, it will apply to all retirement funds. That's what we were trying. That term is loose, but in the legislation, it's more defined. And then coming to the will and the law, the will supersedes. okay. And then SAS will... Okay, it was regard to Section 24J and Section 20. With regard to Section 24J and Section 24I, that those are merely accounting principles put into tax law. I will ask Ronel, who's the accountant, to clarify that exactly to you because I'm a lawyer. And Franz, we're going to talk about the income of PBOs because that is an admin issue, not a policy issue.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I'll try to simplify it, and if it's not clear, you may ask questions. So 24J basically deals with the timing of incurral and accrual of interest. So a simple example is if you have a loan from a bank, so what we do is we try to apply accounting principles to determine how to calculate and include or deduct the interest in determining your taxable income. 24I deals with exchange items, and that is an example of that would be if you have a foreign denominated loan, so a loan in US dollars basically. So what it does is it determines the calculation and inclusion or deduction of your foreign exchange gains or losses in determining your taxable income. So those are mostly accounting rules which we try to align with our income tax legislation.
Thank you, Chair. The question of churches and other public benefit organizations that are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. So part of the conditions of being approved as being tax exempt is that you apply your funds for the purposes for which you are tax exempt. So that comes to SARS's attention. We can revoke the tax exemption. There's also a provision in Section 30 of the Income Tax Act that says that if you're paying remuneration to an office bearer, that is, and I'll get the exact wording here, which is excessive having regard to what is generally considered reasonable in the sector. Again, that's something that's a strike against you for the purposes of maintaining your tax exemption. So it's quite possible to lose your tax exemption if you're engaging in this. There's a slightly separate but related question which talks to trading activities. So you may have a public benefit organization that on the one hand is doing its good work and then on the other hand is also running a business and it takes those profits and brings them across to continue doing the good work. That business undertaking is subject to tax. So we try and police the boundaries to make sure that there isn't abuse. And I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to comment on the answer to the question of my colleague about the pension funds. I know we don't want to get into a long debate on it, but when it comes to a pension fund, it is the trustees that actually decide. It is not the will that actually is the deciding factor. So I don't know if it was a misunderstanding or something, but I just thought I'd mention it because I know that keeps coming up all the time. So if that's the question, if the question is if there's a pension fund and there's beneficiaries, etc., and there's a will, it is the trustees that decide who the dependents are and then pay that way. The will actually doesn't decide it. But maybe there was confusion. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. And Louis?
Sir, if I may just follow up on that question, on that answer you've just given. Given the many examples we see of really egregious and horrifying abuse by, one must say with great sadness, evangelical churches in particular. How many have you deregistered for tax exemption?
That's not a question I can answer being on the policy side, but we can certainly try and get it for you. I think we're also proceeding from the assumption that many of these are in fact getting a PBO status. I mean, it may well be that some of them are not sub-PBOs and have not in fact got tax-exempt status. So, I mean, you need to slice this carefully, because you may have some that are simply doing what they're doing and they have never applied for PBO status. So then they're just taxable. You have those that have applied for PBO status and not complying with their conditions, and there the factors that I've mentioned come into play. But I can certainly see if we can get you that information.
Just one thing. This is a very important issue. We can't settle it here. It's just a signal to France, right? It is the poor and the disadvantaged who are primarily paying for these business churches, as they are, these fly-by-nights, right? Some of these people have been appearing in court repeatedly for abuse of women and so on. And this is a government-wide thing. Something has to be done about this, really. Because, again, it's disproportionately very disadvantaged and peripheralized and marginalized people who are paying disproportionately for these business churches, as they call it. Secondly, there is what we did with the property rates bill, Comrade Chair and colleagues, is we said where you have a bona fide church or mosque or temple or synagogue or whatever, which is used for a place of worship, obviously you cannot tax that in terms of property rates. Interestingly, the most vigorous opponent of that was myself as an atheist, and Hogarth picked it up. As I remember, to go to church every Sunday, I had to remind them, if the church is going to be paying taxes, when you go on a Sunday, instead of paying your 20 rands, you were paying 200 rands. And that made some of them wilt. Now, the thing is that the problem we had when we deal with the property rates bill is while the place of worship can't be taxed, if a part of it is used as a bookshop or whatever, and they're reaping profits, then that part of the church or religious site is taxed. But there's not just the churches, there's the Islamic Propagation Center and so on. What they do is they hire out part of their properties and they raise huge profits and they try to escape paying taxes, property rates in that case. And we said no, any profit or revenue raising effort that is linked to a commercial transaction, that cannot be applied property rates to. That must be applied property rates to. Everything else. So this is a very important issue. I think it's going to be with us. It never struck me until you raised it, Chairperson, that we have to find other ways of dealing with these people. They are making super profits. They have 3 and 4 houses. They have Porsches, and these are religious people, so-called. It's a very good point, Comrade Chair. I think we need to speak to the Social Development Committee and others. We must do our bit. We are parliamentarians. This has to be stopped.
One has hope they are honest when they answer their tax form, but anyway, on their income.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I might be going off the point. I'd like to know, with Honourable Karim referring to the poor also obviously taking a bite on the tax burden that's laying on all of us, on average, what amount of a rand stays in the pocket and what percentage goes to tax with everything that's being taxed from different levels? If you go on average for the general public.
So we don't, everybody's different, but I mean the way we normally look at it is the tax per GDP, so how much gross domestic product is the country producing in one go, and that's around 26%. If you look at it with different definitions and include some municipal, it goes up to about 29%, 28%. So we're overall a bit lower than the OECD average. We're a bit higher than other countries on the same per capita basis, but that's around about where we are, so just less than 30%.
The next item is taxation of financial institutions and products. Thank you, Comrade. You can see that when there is accounting, we are trying so hard to balance the accounting principles and the tax principles. Currently, the Income Tax Act has got special dispensation only for listed rates. And the reason why we have special dispensation for listed rates is that they are transparent, they are listed in the stock exchange, so it's easier to obtain information. So if a REIT distributes rental income, it qualifies for this special dispensation. So it came to our attention that they came to us to say that in order to increase their investments, they are investing in properties outside South Africa, and in doing so, they have to hedge for foreign exchange gains and losses. And the issue is that the foreign exchange gains and losses are not included in the definition of rental income, whereas they are doing that to obtain rental income. So what you are doing this year, we are expanding the definition of rental income so to include any foreign exchange gains in respect of exchange item only related to the rental income. The next one is the refinement to the taxation of risk policy funds of long-term insurance. In 2016, we introduced a fifth fund, which is the risk policy for taxation of long-term insurance. And in doing so, we separated the risk policy from other four funds. So, and the risk policy was defined to exclude any contract of insurance in terms of which annuities are being paid. So the long-term insurers came to us to say that it may happen that in the beginning the policy is a risk policy, but now later it needs to be transferred to another policy fund. So we told them that if it is like that, in order to remove the administrative burden, we're going to make changes so as to allow that, so that they can be able to transfer. Okay, the next one is the tax incentives. Currently, the Income Tax Act has got a venture capital company tax dispensation, which makes provision for you as an individual or a company, if you invest into a VCC, or which that VCC invests into a qualifying company, you get an upfront tax deduction. It does not matter how much. It can be 100 million, it can be 20 million, it can be 10 million. Last year, we made changes in the Income Tax Act as to close abusive structures whereby you find that an individual or a company invest in a VCC, but now the qualifying company, there is a structure whereby it also trades with this VCC. So meaning that you are trading within yourself, whereas you received an upfront tax deduction. So last year we made changes to the VCC tax regime so as to close only those abusive structures. So it came to our attention that the ultra high net worth individuals and the family offices opt to invest just before the end of the tax year large amounts into a VCC so as to get the tax deduction. So what we are doing this year in order to close that gap is to say that because currently you do not have a limitation as to the amount that you can deduct. Even if you can invest 100 million, you deduct it upfront. So this year we are saying that in order to limit this, because the VCC has got a sunset clause, by 2021 they are coming to an end. So we are signaling that this regime is coming to an end. Starting from next year, you are only allowed to deduct up to 2.5 million. So we are putting a cap on the amount that you are able to deduct upfront. So if you invest 5 million, you can only deduct 2.5 million. That is what you are proposing to do. And our proposal is not new, because when the VCC came into effect in 2009 or 2011, there was a cap of 750,000. But because there was no uptake in the VCC, we removed the cap. So upon removal of the cap, there is too much uptake in the VCC, too much. So now we are bringing back the cap. But the VCC is ending in 2021. I don't know whether Momo wants to say that. Okay. The next special incentive issue, tax incentive issue, is the special economic zones. What happened is that in 2013, the SEZ was introduced, but the Act was only promulgated in 2016. So we were told by companies operating in the SEZ that By 2013, before the Act was promulgated, they started operating businesses in the SEZ. And they operated in a business model that was agreed to, but before the legislation was passed. So it has come to our, so now, the Income Tax Act last year, we made provision for the SEZ to be taxable at 15% if you are a qualifying company within an SEZ instead of a 28% of which the companies are subject to tax. That is an incentive. So because you are giving this incentive, we have anti-avoidance measures in the SEZ because the SEZ was meant for export orientation. So now we found that there are businesses that are operating within the SEZ but selling to other South African businesses that are connected person to them that are outside the SEZ. So to us, it defeats the whole purpose of SEZ because SEZ was meant for export orientation. So now what we are making here, we are trying to make to strengthen the anti-avoidance measures so that if you are selling to if you are from an SEZ and you are selling to a connected person within the SEZ, outside the SEZ, you should be selling only not more than 20%. Previously, we had an all-or-nothing approach to say that if you are selling more than 20%, you are not getting the 15% rate. But we are saying now, if you are selling more than 20%, the 20% will qualify for the 15%. Anything above the 20% won't qualify for the 15% rate. And then we are introducing another test, which is in the SEZ policy, that when you go to the SEZ, it should be new business or expansion. Because what we see now is businesses relocating from non-special economic zone to the special economic zone so as to get the tax benefit within the SEZ. So we are also trying to avoid that.
These questions, Louis?
Thank you, ma'am. Just some further clarity on that. Can you just explain what you mean by, do you mean that only 20% of their business can be selling to local companies, and above that, or 20% is focused on export? If I can just have clarity on that before I ask my question, Chair, because I'm not quite sure what was meant there.
Okay. The anti-avoidance measure is saying that if you are from an SEZ, it's not local, connected persons. So if you are an SEZ, you are selling to your subsidiary. Anything above 20%, is regarded, you can sell up to 20% of the goods. Anything above 20% selling to your connected person will be regarded as tainted,
right,
subject to the anti-avoidance rule.
Okay, then my question is just, we've got certain SEZs that have a sector-specific focus, which are definitely selling locally. I think, for example, of Atlantis, which is designated specifically to focus on renewable energy investments, where those are foreign companies moving into the SEZ, building photovoltaic cells, wind towers, etc., for installation in South Africa. So is that going to disqualify them? Because that would also defeat the object of that SEZ.
If you are selling to a connected person, so you can sell locally, but if you are selling to a connected person, it's not going to disqualify them, but you are saying that any amount, when you are selling to a connected person, because local cannot be connected person, so any sales above 20% will be subject to the 28% tax rate. Sales below 20% to a connected person will be subject to 15% rate. But if you are selling locally to an unconnected person, you still qualify.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, my questions relate to the venture capital company provisions. And taking into account that access to capital is one of the most cited reason for businesses not making it, or the lack of access to capital, I would think that this venture capital company provision would be something we would like to encourage. Certainly with a view to growing the economy going forward and certainly putting the burden on more entrepreneurs. So I'm intrigued, therefore, to hear that there's a horizon of 2021 on this allowance or allowable deduction. And I'd like to hear the reasons for that, because I think this should be something that we would be encouraging rather than doing away with. In addition to which, I think that whilst I hear that the previous cap was too low, then the removal of the cap meant that it was too high. We're looking for a middle ground, and I can see how it's being abused by people who come as a last minute, and you know, based on tax advice, they would dump all their money into something and then withdraw it early in the new year. Would it not be able to link it to some sort of a timing thing as well, so to have not just an amount limit, but an amount over a period of time creates deductibility? I'm not sure what the practical implications of that would be.
Thank you. With regard to the sunset clause, all tax incentives in the income tax sector have got a sunset clause. We normally have them for 10 years, even the SEZ, they've got a sunset clause, because when you give a tax incentive, you must, after some time, you must reevaluate and check if it's working for the intended benefit. So in 2021, that is the sunset clause, which is in the Income Tax Act. So most of the tax incentives have got a sunset clause for reevaluation and check if it's still for the intended benefit. So the sunset clause has always been there. And then with regard to the cap, I think you agree with us that it can be subject to abuse, the amount, if there is no cap. So hence we are introducing a cap.
Is it the best way, sorry?
We don't know, but based on the comments received, you can see that they are saying it's not the best way, but Parliament will guide us, and then it's going to come to Parliament, and then they can say if they agree or not agree.
But can I say, Chair, I mean, just generally, you prefer a system, ideally, where you rather have low rates than tax incentives. And incentives are inefficient, and they're open to abuse. And I think here, clearly, there is a sense that the abuse is big.
If you can take all the slides so that we can go to the next presentation and finish in time. There is an important matter to be debated in the House on Women's Day. So we must break in time so that we go to lunch and everybody is going to be late in the House today.
A practical issue. The National Council of Provinces has got a strategy workshop. We were exempted from this workshop till 12:30. So for those of you wanting a lift in Kulalekul, just sorry, because people might, we're going to the Cape Lodge somewhere because there's no venue here. Where is it? Where do you collect a taxi or Kumbi or whatever? Outside.
Right outside my cousin.
Yeah. But it doesn't stop the NA from sitting till 1. We merely have to leave at 12:30. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go first on international tax. The most important one in the international tax is reviewing the comparable tax exemption of controlled foreign companies. Currently, we've got a comparable tax exemption whereby if you're a South African multinational operating offshore and you are paying tax at least 75% in the offshore country, then that income is not included in your South African taxable income. And then that exemption was introduced so as to allow South African multinationals to be comparable offshore. So now we've seen that most countries, especially the UK, which is our largest trading partner and of which most of the South African nationals are operating in, have reduced their tax, their corporate income tax to 19% in 2019 and in 17% in 2020. It's the gradual reduction. So now this is forcing us to review the comparable tax exemption. So in 2019, we are proposing to reduce it from 75% to 67.5%. I think we can go through this one, and then the next important one is the VAT one.
Thank you, Yanga. Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. So, Section 72, and I expect the committees will hear a fair amount about this too, is a provision which allows the Commissioner to
essentially modify the Tax Act, and in this case the VAT Act, and it's a unique provision to the VAT Act, to cater for difficulties, anomalies, or incongruities. And it allows the commissioner to, in fact, allow exemptions, allow zero ratings. It's a pretty broadly drafted provision. And so questions have arisen as to whether this is in fact compatible with the constitutional scheme in South Africa, which is that you should not really have a DG equivalent, being the commissioner overriding what Parliament had to say on the matter. So we've looked at it quite carefully, and what we've come up with is a number of restrictions on what the commissioner can do to address these difficulties, anomalies, and incongruities. So, for example, we're proposing to delete the commissioner's power to grant an exemption or a zero rating. I should add there is a qualifier to that. The commissioner may not substantially increase or reduce the amount of VAT that becomes due or payable or is refundable. But then, of course, the debate shifts to what does substantially mean, and should this be a power that the commissioner should have at all. So we're proposing to restrict the provisions of Section 72 quite dramatically, and I do flag that this is unique to the VAT Act. It seems to us to have been a transitional measure. Unfortunately, I was nowhere near the legislative process when this was brought in. It was carried over from the General Sales Tax Act previous to it, and from what we've been able to ascertain from the records, this was meant to be transitional, and seems to be one of those transitional measures that's lived on well past its initial thought. So if we could move on.
The next one is on the proposal that was made in Chapter 4 of the Budget Review on the ad valorem excise duty on motor vehicles. Just to give a bit of background, so the ad valorem excise duty is basically a tax on final goods and is meant as a luxury tax. So there were lots of discussions last year about VAT and call for a luxury VAT. The Treasury's response was we already have an ad valorem excise duty regime which is supposed to be applied on luxurious products and has a higher rate, so it acts the same way without the difficulties of having a multi-tiered VAT system. So on vehicles that are produced, there is a progressive rate, so low-value vehicles pay less and higher-value vehicles pay more, up to a cap of 30%. So there's I've just shown in slide 67, there's a formula for locally manufactured vehicles and there's a formula for imported vehicles. Now the base, the amount of which that tax is calculated, is different between locally manufactured and imported duties vehicles. The interesting part is that for imported vehicles, the ad valorem amount that is charged in that vehicle is calculated on the value after rebated customs duties through the Automotive Production Development Program, which is the APDP program, which is run by the DTI. So in effect, with that incentive program, if you produce vehicles locally, you get a production rebate credit certificate, and then you can use that to offset the import duty that you have on imported vehicles. Now, the ad valorem is then charged on the value of the imported vehicle after offsetting the import duties based on the production rebate credit certificate. So in effect, this leads to a lower ad valorem tax that is paid on imported vehicles and a higher ad valorem tax on local vehicles. So as part of the current APDP negotiations and the move towards the SA Automotive Master Plan, which is from 2021 to 2035, the DTI proposed changes to the Treasury to say that we need to neutralize the impact so that the taxation on locally manufactured vehicles is the same as the tax on imported vehicles, which would then promote the production of local vehicles so that they're not taxed at a higher level. So this change then says that the amount of tax that you pay for ad valorem won't be after the incentives you get from the APDP. It'll be calculated on a higher rate. Okay.
And this brings us to the Tax Administration Rules Amendment Bill. We can skip over that. That's just the contents. I'll move through this relatively quickly in the interest of time. So at the moment, you can get a reduced rate on the withholding tax South Africa imposes on royalties and interest if it's in terms of a double taxation agreement we've concluded with another jurisdiction. In order to get it, you need to provide a declaration as the recipient saying, I qualify for this treaty relief to the person who's paying it. And at the moment, that is a per payment declaration that you have to lodge. Now, what happens if you have a monthly royalty payment or interest payment? Well, then you have 12 of these declarations every year. So that does seem a little problematic. So the proposal here is to follow the line that was adopted for a dividends tax, and essentially allow a declaration that is lodged once with an undertaking to notify the payor of any changes, and then that goes on forward. But on reflection, we thought, well, it seems a little odd that that declaration lasts forever. So we've proposed a 2-year period that the declaration holds good, and we are getting some comment on that. People think it's too short. Some people don't see why we should have it at all. So that's going to be an area for some debate. The second one I don't think is too significant in this context, so we can move on. Authorization. Right, so the matter of illicit financial flows is very much on this committee's mind, or it has been in the past, and I'm sure it will be again. And one of the aspects that I'm sure the Honourable Chair will recall was the so-called advanced payments, where a importer goes to an authorized dealer, says, I need $10 million to pay it up front in order to get goods that will be delivered down the line. They get the $10 million, and then strange things happen. Those goods do not come into the country, or only a fraction of them do. Invoices are forged to try and meet documentation requirements, and it becomes a leakage to society. So in order to get better control over this, there's a proposal that, in fact, someone who's applying for such an advance payment needs to notify SARS of the fact. We'll issue them, although this is, we will then issue them with a reference number, which will then allow us to track whether the goods came in, whether the values balance, and in order to close the loop. And so that's something that we would be doing with the authorized dealers and with the traders who are applying for this. Moving on. There is, as is common in many aspects of legislation regarding the state, a notice period if you wish to take us to court. Currently it is a 7-day notice period, or 1 week. And the difficulty we have here is it's actually very hard for our legal teams to in fact resolve an issue within that relatively short period. So we're proposing that that increase effectively to a month, 21 business days, so that we can preclude the need to go to court in the first place and actually resolve the issue up front. One of the criticisms here is, well, do I always have to wait for 21 days? Maybe there's something that's really urgent and I can't. That is already catered for in the legislation. With the permission of the court, you can, in fact, go with a shorter period of notice to SARS. The next one is something to assist a provision that's already part of the law. Everyone in this room is probably familiar with the IT3B you get from your bank that says you earned so much interest in this last year. The Common Reporting Standard makes that an international concept so that we can get the equivalent information from other tax jurisdictions that we have treaties with. And so that allows us to track income across the world as opposed to just in South Africa. Unsurprisingly, people are trying to come up with mechanisms to circumvent those reporting requirements, and so the OECD has come up with a set of what they call model disclosure rules, so that if a intermediary becomes aware of such a structure that's being pushed in the market, it needs to be reported. And so this is the proposal here, that we incorporate the ability for the Minister of Finance to, in fact, issue those model disclosure rules as part of the CRS regulations, and that if you do not, in fact, report as you're supposed to, SARS can impose a penalty.
tax compliance certificates. If you wish to tender for government business, you need such a thing. But that system has been updated over time, and we currently have moved away from a piece of paper that you need to get to something that you can do completely electronically. And so that's much more efficient. It's much more timeous. And essentially what we're proposing here is to update the law to cater for that switch. The law was drafted for that transition, so trying to cover both bases, it's no longer necessary to cover the piece of paper, so we're moving it on. At least that's what we're proposing to Parliament.
Thank you very much, Franz. Over to members. Yes. Next, who else wants to speak?
No, thank you very much, sir. My question is on SFCs, Control Foreign Companies, CFCs, yes. Well, I just wanted to know, Chairperson, how will the reduction on income tax of these multinational companies affect or benefit the country from a revenue perspective?
Thank you. Who's next? No further questions? Okay, over to you, Yolanda.
Currently, South Africa has controlled foreign company rules whereby if you are a South African resident and you have more than 50, you own more than 50% of a company that is a foreign company, then the income is taxable in the South African residency because we've got a worldwide system of taxation. So we don't want you to hide your income by saying that you have a foreign company. But if you've got more than 50%, the income is attributable to you. So when we're introducing these rules, we were told that if a company is operating in a high-tax country, for instance, a comparable 75 is paying 75% of tax there, meaning that it's going to be administratively burdensome to pay tax here, there, and also pay tax in South Africa because you have to wait for foreign tax credit. So we said, okay, because you cannot be in a high-tax country but you are trying to avoid tax. You are there because you've got a legitimate business purpose as to why you are there. So we took a figure because we made calculations, and then we say that if you are paying 75% of tax there, then no income will be taxable in the South African residence. Hence, no income will be subject to tax here in South Africa. So now, because the high tax countries or like our trading partners, like your UK, is globally they are reducing their corporate tax rates. Meaning that our 75% comparable is high, that effective tax rate. So we have to keep up with the trends. So we are reducing it to 67. So now, because UK is saying that by 2020 it should be 17%, we may consider reducing it further again. Yeah.
Anything else?
No. Are we actually done? Oh, right. Oh. Okay, so those of you that joined the NCLP strategy meeting from the NA, you're very welcome. Okay, just to end, the chair is not here. It's mainly an NA because the bill is mainly here. But on his behalf and our behalf, we thank the Treasury, but also to alert new members and even older members, this is the most difficult part of our work, okay? It's very technical. So if you're feeling slightly ill at ease or bewildered, it's fine. We all went through that in 2014. And I still find it very taxing listening to you this morning. The second thing to say is that this is a first bite, initial foray. Don't worry, we'll have public hearings where things get very much more simplified. And thirdly, for those of you who want things simplified, you can turn to the researchers, but you could also try our most active member of this committee, Linda Enso, works for Business Day. She's been to more committee meetings than all committee members. And she can explain to you what that is. But be careful. She represents monopoly capital. Big business, you have to be careful. But Linda, I must tell you, for those who are new, I always said, remember Tikaleri, she's the best member of this committee. Her attendance rate is 110%. Yeah, one of my thousands. Okay, so there you are. Thank you all.